The Guardian. Guardian Books is pleased to present listeners of this podcast with a special offer on House of Fun, a bumper collection of Simon Hoggart's 20 years of parliamentary sketch writing.
Labour launched its manifesto yesterday, or rather, it opened a coal hole and poured several tons of nutty slack down on the voters.
I am extremely calm,
the Prime Minister replied, but he said it like Herbert Lom as Inspector Clouseau's boss. Caroline Flint is regarded as something of a hard-line toady, an aardvark-tongued bootlicker, a member of an active service unit in the greaser's provisional wing.
To get your hardback copy of Simon's book for half price, go to guardianbookshop.co.uk/Hoggart and enter the code Hoggart. This offer is for 2 weeks only and is exclusive to this podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. It's the run-up to Christmas, and we're decorating our podcast shop window with a beautiful book club, Philip Pullman talking about his new version of Grimm's Fairy Tales. It's been published by Penguin Classics under the all-inclusive title Grimm Tales for Young and Old. He began his conversation with John Mullen by reading one of the tales, The Robber Bridegroom.
There was once a miller who had a beautiful daughter. When she came of age to be married, he thought he should look out for a suitable husband for her. Anyone respectable comes along, he said to himself, I'll give her to him. Word got around, and before long a gentleman appeared to ask about this beautiful daughter. The miller interviewed him, found no fault with him, and promised that he could marry her. But the daughter didn't take to him at all. There was something about him she didn't trust, and whenever she thought about him or heard his name mentioned, she felt her heart contract with horror. One day the prospective bridegroom said to her, you know, my dear, we're engaged to be married, but you've never paid me a visit. Why not come to my house? After all, it will soon be your own home. I don't know where your house is, the girl said. It's out in the forest, he told her. Beautiful situation, you'll see. I don't think I'll ever be able to find my way there, she said. No, no, you must come on Sunday. I've already invited some guests. They're looking forward to meeting you. I'll make a trail of ashes so you can follow it through the trees. On Sunday, the girl felt an awful foreboding. She'd rather do anything than set off through the woods to the bridegroom's house. She filled her pockets with peas to mark the trail in case anything happened. At the edge of the forest, she found the trail of ashes, and after every step, she threw a couple of peas to left and right. She walked almost the whole day till she came to a part of the forest where the trees grew so thick and high that it was dark underneath them, and there, right in the heart of the woods, she found the bridegroom's house. It was dark and silent and seemed to be deserted. There was no one inside but a bird in a cage, and he was no comfort either, because all he could sing was, turn back, get out, go home, take care, this is a murderer's house, beware. She looked up at the bird and said, can't you tell me any more than that, little bird? The bird said again, turn back, get out, go home, take care, this is a murderer's house, beware. The bride wandered from one room to another, but she didn't see anyone till she went down to the cellar. There she found a very old woman sitting by the light of a fire, shaking her head. Please can you tell me if my bridegroom lives here, said the girl. Oh, you poor child, replied the bold woman. Why ever did you come to this house? It's a den of murderers. You talk of a bridegroom, the only bridegroom you'll be marrying is death. See this big pot of water on the fire? They made me set it there to boil. When they turn up, they're going to chop you in pieces and throw you in the pot, cook you till you're tender and eat you all up. They're a pack of cannibals. Now, I've taken pity on you, my dear, because you're a poor innocent thing, and besides, you've got a very pretty face. Come over here. The old woman led her behind a large barrel where she was out of sight from the rest of the cellar. Stay there and don't make a sound, she said. If they hear you, that's the end of you. When they're asleep later on, we'll escape. No sooner had she said this than the band of murderers came home, dragging with them another girl whom they'd captured. She screamed and sobbed, but they were drunk and took no notice of her pleas for mercy. They forced her to drink a glass of red wine, then a glass of white, and then one of yellow, and the third one was too much for her. Her heart burst apart. Then they tore off her fine clothes and laid her on the table before chopping her in pieces and sprinkling her with salt. The poor bride-to-be behind the barrel trembled in every limb, seeing what fate the murderers had in mind for her. Then one of them saw a gold ring on the dead girl's finger. He took an axe and chopped the finger off, but it flew in the air and right over the barrel and into the bride's lap. He couldn't see where it had gone, so he took a light and looked for it. Another murderer said, "Look behind the big barrel, I think it went over there." But the old woman called out, "Come and eat your supper, the finger won't run away, you can find it in the morning." "She's right," said the others, and they pulled up chairs and sat down to eat. The old woman poured a sleeping draught in their wine, so that before they'd even finished eating, they all slumped to the floor and fell asleep. When the bride heard them snoring, she crept out from behind the barrel. She had to step over the sleeping murderers where they all lay on the cellar floor. She was terribly afraid she'd step on one and wake him up. "Dear God, help me," she whispered. And she got to the cellar steps safely where the old woman was waiting. They crept upstairs, opened the door, and hurried out as fast as they could. It was as well that the girl had brought peas to throw on the ground, because the ashes that shone the path had all blown away. The peas had sprouted, though, and in the moonlight they could see them, and they followed the trail all the way to the mill, where they arrived just as the sun was rising. The girl told her father everything that had happened from beginning to end, and the old woman confirmed it. When the wedding day arrived, the bridegroom appeared, smiling all round and being present to everyone. The miller had invited all his relations and all his friends, and they were impressed by this handsome, friendly man. As they sat down to eat, each guest was asked to tell a story. The bride said nothing at all as they listened to the stories going round the table, and finally the bridegroom said, "Come on, my darling, haven't you got a story to tell? Just tell us something." So she said, "All right, I'll tell you about a dream I had. I was walking in the forest when I came to a dark house. There wasn't a soul in sight. There was only a little bird in a cage that said, 'Turn back, get out, go home, take care. This is a murderer's house, beware.' It said that twice, but my dear heart, it was only a dream. I went through all the rooms, and although there was no one there, something was uncanny about the place. Finally, I went down to the cellar where I found an old woman shaking her head. I said to her, 'Does my bridegroom live in this house?' She said, 'Alas, poor child, you're in the house of a murderer. Your bridegroom does live here, but he's going to chop you into pieces and cook you and eat you.' 'That isn't so,' said the bridegroom." "Dear heart, don't worry," she said, "it was only a dream. The old woman hid me behind a great big barrel, and as soon as I was there, the robbers came back, dragging a poor girl with them, screaming and pleading for mercy. They forced her to drink 3 glasses of wine, one red, one white, and one yellow, and that made her heart burst apart, so she died."
"That isn't so, and it wasn't so," cried the bridegroom.
"Darling, sit still, it was only a dream. They took off her fine clothes, they laid her on the table and chopped her to pieces and sprinkled salt on them."
"That isn't so, and it wasn't so, and God forbid it should be so," shouted the bridegroom.
"Dear heart, stay where you are, it's only a dream." Then one of the robbers saw a gold ring on the poor girl's finger. He took an axe and chopped it off, and the finger flew through the air and landed in my lap. And here is that finger with the ring. With those words, she held up the finger and the ring so everyone could see. The bridegroom, who had become as white as chalk, leapt up and tried to escape. But the guests seized him and held him tight, then marched him to the court. Soldiers were sent out to capture the rest of the band, and they were all put to death for their wicked deeds.
So why do you particularly like that one?
Because I like saying, "That isn't so, and it wasn't so, and God forbid it should be so." Which, if anybody here has recently played Benedick in Much Ado About Nothing, you'll recognise that line, because in the first scene, Benedict says to Don Pedro, I think, "To my lord, as the old tale has it, it isn't so, and it wasn't so, and God forbid it should be so." So that was an old tale then. There are several very good English versions of this story. There's one called The Cellar of Blood, which is a marvellous title. There's another one called Mr. Fox, in which those words occur in that, at that point. So I thought it would be a good idea to pinch them and put them in, because I wasn't doing a translation, a sort of faithful literary translation of the stories. I was trying to make little twists and improve them where I could, and tighten them up occasionally, and tidy them and sharpen them and bring them into focus a little bit more.
So that's a kind of specimen of what you were doing with all the stories.
Yeah,
you were making,
yes.
Yeah.
And I also like it because it's not what we think of as a fairy tale. Why we call these stories fairy tales is a mystery to me, but that's the way we've always referred to this sort of story. Very, very few fairies in any of these stories.
When you're making these changes, do you think that fairy tales, as we call them, are particularly open to changes and adaptations?
Yes, well, oral tales are, traditional tales are, definitely, which these are, of course. These were not written by the Brothers Grimm, they were written down by the Brothers Grimm, but at the dictation of people who knew the stories and had known them for generations. Another thing I learned when doing this book was, well, it enlightened me about what the Grimms themselves did. I had the romantic idea that they roamed the fields and the forests with their knapsacks and notebooks saying, "Good morning, Herr Peasant," or "Guten Morgen, Herr Peasant." Please tell me a story. And then they read it. But it wasn't like that at all. That story came to them from a friend of the family. And most of the stories did. They had a sort of wide social circle. They were academics themselves, members of the middle class, you could say. And most of the stories came to them from friends, relations, people of that sort.
You can see why a certain kind of academic in the early 20th century, a narratologist, they loved these. Oh, the trail through the forest, the talking bird, the old woman, the miller, even, you know, why are there so many millers? There's loads and loads of millers. But then also more sort of subtly, in a way, you chose one which has this kind of quite subtle version of what lots of them have, which is these structures of repetition, usually in threes, of course. You actually say in one of your notes the three-ishness of, of lots of these. Yeah. And that story actually involves something which is completely alien to the form of narratives that we're more used to, perhaps, novels in particular, which is it tells a story and then the woman, the daughter, tells a story all over again, in a way, words we've heard before.
But every theory, I think, is interesting in a way, because you can look at stories like this which form good things to look at through the filter of a theory and see all sorts of things that you can't see without the theory. They're really there. The theory's not making them up, but you can't see them without the theory. But if you look at them through a different filter, you see different things.
They give no depth of psychology. They give no... Nobody's got a name except a typical name. Nobody's got a unique identity. They're all princes or princesses or millers or whatever. There's no unpredictability. Au contraire, they celebrate predictability, don't they?
Very little description. And what description is always conventional. Forests are always deep. Hair is always golden. Princesses are always beautiful. I like that, actually. I find that very refreshing. It's a very, it's so different, as you were saying, from what we do in the novel, where we expect this subtle interplay of motive and memory and reflection and you know, impulse to be the almost the main subject matter of the novel, as it has been certainly for the last 100 years. It's just not there in these tales. There ain't no psychology. There's no depth to them. No depth to the characters, I mean to say.
There is something in the stories which feels like a sort of, these are the basic formulae of stories.
It's almost abstract.
And then you take, you know, I was reading Cinderella. We all think we know Cinderella. And of course, one of the things about these stories, if people haven't read them in, as it were, the original, is that will surprise you, is that some of the best known stories aren't like one thinks. Yeah. And so Cinderella, which involves a good deal of sort of mutilation, actually. You may not think it does, but it does in a version, in your version, which is quite close to Grimm's version. I would say in these stories, the 50 you've chosen, almost half of them start with a daughter. Usually it's a daughter, isn't it, rather than a son, and a stepmother. Mm. Why, do you think?
I can't remember if it's in Bruno Bettelheim's Freudian study. Well, children do have these murderous feelings of hatred for their parents. But they're very hard to face and very hard to bear. But if you put a step-parent there instead, it's easier to cope with. My real mother wouldn't hate me as you do, wouldn't treat me like this. The same goes in real family dynamics with stepfathers. I know, because I had one. Mm. He was a good man. But there were some times when I thought my real father would be nicer to me than you are.
Yeah.
It's a way of displacing the natural feelings of that all children have sometimes, of resentment or whatever it is for their parents.
Yeah, and it produces this really very elemental, powerful narrative electricity that this is somebody who pretends to be or is supposed to be nice. And in fact, in several of the stories, it's not just they're nasty, they're murderous. They're absolutely murderous.
Well, the best of all those stories is The Juniper Tree.
Yes.
Which I think is the most marvellous work of art, an absolutely supreme example of how to tell a story. And that was, incidentally, one of the, as well as having the most evil stepmother in the world, that was one of the few stories that came to the Grimms in manuscript form. It was written by a painter, Philip Otto Runge, very interesting painter, who died fairly young, I think. And he was responsible for two of the best stories here. And they both have, as I put it, noted in my notes, they both have an odd quality about them, his two stories. They're very hard to improve. They're very hard to make better when you're telling them. You have to, if you want to make them, have them, let them have their full impression,
You have to do exactly what he does and use exactly the same words and the same phrases in the same order. And that's true of none of the other stories. Mm. It's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
And it's because I think they are really works of literary art rather than primarily oral tales.
And the juniper tree is a fierce. I mean, it's got murder, cannibalism, and then another thing about them, which is completely unapologetic, retribution.
Yes.
You know that the bad person will be done in, but frequently that means they will be put in a barrel with spikes on the inside, whilst everybody else is getting married.
Well, Cinderella is an example. Yes. On the way to the church, the two wicked sisters have an eye pecked out by a dove.
Yeah.
And on the way out of church, they walk on the other side, so the other eye gets pecked out. It's another indication that we're not to take these stories literally, I think. They're puppet shows, in a way. The characters aren't real, they're flat, as we pointed out. And I think the sort of punishments meted out to them, which it would be too horrible to think of that happening to a real person. If you contrast that with what happens in King Lear, that is almost unbearable, because we know that the person it's happening to has the sort of psychic dimensions of a human being, whereas the ugly sisters are just caricatures.
Yeah. I want to ask you. I want to ask you one more question before I turn it over, which is also a kind of, can you explain for me, please, Philip, this thing that always happens, which is actually on the journey here. I asked my daughter what the difference was between Grimm's tales and Hans Christian Andersen, and she suggested, I don't know how well this thesis will stand up, and Hans Christian Andersen tales, when they die, they go to heaven.
Yeah.
But in Grimm tales, when they die, they come back to life. The good people, this is. The bad people don't. There's an awful lot of resurrection, isn't there?
Well, that's very astute, yes. That does happen. People get a poison apple stuck in their throat and they come to life again. In the juniper tree, to use the example we were talking about just now, the little boy's resurrected. But somehow that feels true. There's been a sort of artistic sensibility at work on it, and it feels true and it feels right. It doesn't feel grotesque and silly.
Let me stop and turn it over. We've got travelling mics.
Would you ever try writing a modern fairy tale? Because all of these are set like in a distant past with no technology. So do you think it could still work if there was technology involved and buses and cars and things?
That's a good question. I don't think I would, because I mean, I've written four longer stories than these, which I call my fairy tales. There's one called The Firework Maker's Daughter, I Was a Rat, there's another one, Clockwork, and The Scarecrow and His Servant. But I've set them in fairy tale land, so to speak, in the past. The real invention of the devil, as far as the storyteller is concerned, is the mobile phone. Nothing can possibly go wrong. Lost in the forest? Oh, Dad, I'm lost in the forest. Uh-huh. Okay. Stay there, I'll pick you up. It's not reality, it's something else. It's like the commedia dell'arte. The masks.
Okay. Yeah, please. I just wondered if you could say more about the story you liked, why you liked it, because you haven't really said a great deal about that.
The Robber Bridegroom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a good gory old shocker. And I like that about it. It's very neatly constructed. There's nothing, and in fact this is true of the best of these stories, there's no fat in it, you know, there's no flab. It's all lean, muscular storytelling. This happened and then that happened, and you see why, and this leads on to the next. Nothing supernatural in it at all, no magic whatsoever.
And you've been inhabiting these stories, and they've been inhabiting you now for quite a while. Do you have an inkling as to where... As to the contribution that these might make in your own writing?
Not directly, because what I'm doing at the moment is writing a novel. But I have been spending time with this sort of tale. Before this, I did my Jesus book, which again was, if you like, oral narratives that had been written down in various ways. And that was interesting too. As far as making a difference the way I write is concerned... I think I use fewer adverbs now than I... But also the swiftness of the transitions. Once upon a time, and then two paragraphs later, he's already married the princess, and she's... etc. I love that swiftness. But it's not an easy thing to combine with a novel that has some pretensions towards realism.
Hi. We've been asked by a bunch of school children to ask if you had a favourite book when you were a child, and why you liked it, and if it still stays with you.
I had a number of favourites, I suppose, like every child who reads. I had a small number of books I used to go back to again and again. One was the first of Arthur Ransom's books, Swallows and Amazons. I like them all, but I like that one best. It was about children whom I liked and whom I could imagine myself being friends with, doing things that I wished I was able to do myself. I think that's a lot of what attracts us to a story when we're young, precisely the opposite of what Howard Jacobson was saying recently about, you know, a woman didn't like this book because there was no one in it to identify with. But I didn't want to be one of them. I wanted to be in the story with them, but still myself. That's the thing. Another of my favourites was a book called The Magic Pudding by the Australian writer Norman Lindsay. It's about the only thing of his that remains alive after 100 years. It's very, very funny. A lovely book. I also like The Moomins.
Ah.
Tove Jansson. For the same reason that, you know, I wanted to be their friend.
Lady, yes, please.
When the stories were originally told, who do you think they were told to? Children or adults or both? And what was the purpose? Was it for entertainment or was there a kind of warning in it? So in that story, was it about don't go into the woods with strange men?
Or don't do what your father arranges for you.
Yeah. Don't go into the woods with your fiancé, actually.
Just forget the woods, basically. The title of the Grimms gave it was Kinder und Hausmärchen, stories for children and for the household. So they were for old and young, or young and old, as my subtitle implies. So they were certainly not hived away in a separate little enclosure for the children, while the grown-ups went off and played bridge or had affairs or something. But we don't really know, do we? Because we can only suppose that they were stories told around the fire by a member of the family, granny or someone who knew a lot of stories. And everyone listened to them. We don't know. The reason the Grimms got interested in them was not because they wanted to write a nice storybook for all the family. It was because it was for a linguistic reason, a reason to do with their study of philology. That was their academic subject. They were extremely eminent and very important. And they thought that by looking at folk tales, folk poetry and folk songs, that sort of thing, they'd get an idea of the roots of the German language, which for them was more than just a linguistic thing, actually. They thought, following the doctrines of the professor under whom they studied, that the lore of a particular people comes out of its language. It's a sort of organic relationship between language and lore. So that was really what set them looking at folk tales. But they found that when they'd collected this for their high academic philological purpose, when they made this collection and published it, it was enormously popular and everybody read it and bought it and read it to their children and so on. It went on through 7 editions throughout the first half of the 19th century. But we can only guess who the original audience was. I imagine it was like that for everyone.
I was wondering, given the natural medium of the folk tale or the fairy tale is oral, there are stories told around a campfire, do you feel as though anything is lost by writing them down? Or if so, is there any techniques you use to try and retain some of its original character?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's what has inevitably happened. With the with pretty well universal literacy in Western Europe and with the rise of cheap printing techniques and so on, and with the decreasing, the family unit being broken up by industrialization and people going to live in cities and all that sort of stuff, it would have died out if it hadn't been written down. So it was inevitable that these things should be written down. It's a good thing too, otherwise they'd have been lost forever, completely lost. But I think the way to read them and the way to pass them on is to do as I've suggested in the introduction and play with them yourself. Give them your own little spin. Do as I did. Pinch a bit of this story and put it in. In the story of Cinderella, for example, I stole the idea of her 3 dresses of 3 different colours, one the colour of the moon, the other the colour of the sun, the other the colour of the stars, from the British version of Cinderella, which is called Mossy Coat, which is the most wonderful version of it. I think it's actually better than Grimm. And Mossy Coat is a wonderful story. And so I was perfectly ready to pinch things from that. And if you, as a storyteller, feel an affinity for funny stories, then make them funnier. Put your own little bits in a business. If you're really good at making people's flesh creep, then make the punishments even more gruesome. You know, do that. Italo Calvino, the collector of the other great European collection of folk tales, Italian Folk Tales it's called, it's a wonderful book, a marvellous book. He quotes a Tuscan proverb at the beginning of that, which says, the tale is not beautiful if nothing is added to it. So it's your job as a storyteller to make it your own as you tell it.
a bit of a general question.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for writers of both children's and adult books?
Well, you'd be amazed how many people say they want to write books and they don't read. You know, students on creative writing courses, they don't read. Some of them don't. Some of them do, of course, and they're very good. But you've got to read incessantly, omnivorously, voraciously, and not stop reading. That's the first and the most important thing. And if you want to write, well, write to please yourself. Publishers will tell you, you must write a book that was like the ones that were in the bestseller list last year, because that's what we want to publish, and we know that's safe because it was a bestseller. That's a surefire recipe for getting it wrong and not making it work. Write to please yourself. Think of this. How many people were saying, you know, when the second and the third and the fourth book, Harry Potter book came, bring us the next Harry Potter, we want the next Harry Potter. How many were queuing around the block to buy it? Millions and millions. How many people said, we want the first Harry Potter book. Nobody's written a Harry Potter book yet. We wish they'd hurry up. No one. She did it to please herself. Can I just read one more short story?
Yeah.
One short, please. And then we have to go. This is a story called The Moon. A very long time ago, there was a country where the night was always dark. After sunset, the sky covered the world like a black cloth because the moon never rose, and not one star twinkled in the darkness. A long time before that, when the world was created, everything used to glow gently and give enough light to see by, but later on that faded. One day, four young men from that country set out on a journey and came to another kingdom just as the sun was setting behind the mountains. When the sun had gone completely, they stood still in amazement because a gleaming ball appeared at the top of an oak tree and cast a soft light all around. It wasn't as bright as the sun, but it gave enough light to see by and to tell one thing from another. The four travellers had never seen anything like it, so they stopped a farmer who happened to be driving past in his wagon and asked him what it was. Oh, that's the moon, that is, he told them. Our mayor bought it. He paid 3 thalers for it. He's got to pour oil into it every day and keep it clean so it always shines nice and bright, and we pay him 1 thaler a week for his trouble. When the farmer had driven away, one of the young men said, I tell you what, we could use this moon thing at home. My dad's got an oak tree about as big as this in his front garden. I bet he'd let us hang in there. Wouldn't it be good not to have to blunder about in the dark anymore? That's a good idea, said the second. Let's get hold of a wagon and a horse and carry this moon away. I can always buy another. I'm a good climber, said the third. I'll go up and get it. The fourth one fetched a wagon and horses, and the third one climbed the tree, drilled a hole in the moon, passed a rope through it and hauled it down. When they had the glowing ball safely in the wagon, they covered it with a tarpaulin so no one could see what they'd done, and they set off by homewards. Back in their own country, they hung the moon on a tall oak tree. Everyone was delighted when this new lamp cast its light over all the fields and shone through every window. Even the dwarfs came out of their mountain caves to have a look at it, and the little elves in their red jackets danced in the meadows in the moonlight. Four friends looked after the moon. They kept it clean, they trimmed the wick, made sure it was always full of oil. They were paid 1 thaler a week by public subscription. And so it went on till they grew old. One day, one of them felt his death was near. So he sent for the lawyer and changed his will, saying that as 1/4 of the moon was his, it should go into the grave with him. Accordingly, when he died, the mayor of the town climbed the tree and cut off 1/4 of the moon with his municipal secateurs, and it was placed in the coffin. The light from the rest of the moon was a little bit dimmer, but people could still see their way around. When the second one died, another 1/4 of the moon was buried with him, and the light grew dimmer still. Same thing happened with the third, and after the fourth died and was buried, there was no light at all. And when people went out without a lantern, they bumped into things just as they'd done in the old days. When the four parts of the moon were together in the underworld, where it had always been dark, the dead became restless and woke up from their sleep. They were astonished at being able to see again. The moonlight was quite bright enough for them because their eyes had been closed for so long that the sun would have been too bright. They cheered up no end, got out of their graves and began to have a high old time. They played cards, they danced, they went to the taverns and got drunk. They quarrelled and fought and raised their sticks and walloped one another, and the row they made got louder and louder till it reached all the way to heaven. St. Peter, who guards the gate up there, thought a revolution was breaking out, and he called all the heavenly hosts together to repel the devil and his infernal crew. However, when the devils didn't turn up, he got on his holy horse and rode down to the underworld to see what was going on. Lie down, you brutes, he roared. Back in your graves, every one of you. You're dead, and don't you forget it. Then he saw what the problem was. The moon had put itself together again and no one could sleep. So he unhooked it, took it up to heaven, and hung it up where no one could reach. Since then, it shines over every country, no matter where it is. And St. Peter takes a bit away at a time till there's hardly any left and puts them back again over the course of a month to remind people who's boss. He doesn't take the cut-off bits down to the underworld, though. He's got a special cupboard to put them in. It's just as dark down among the dead as it ever was. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Guardian Books is pleased to present listeners of this podcast with a special offer on House of Fun, a bumper collection of Simon Hoggart's 20 years of parliamentary sketch writing.
Labour launched its manifesto yesterday, or rather, it opened a coal hole and poured several tons of nutty slack down on the voters.
I am extremely calm, the Prime Minister replied, but he said it like Herbert Lom as Inspector Clouseau's boss. Caroline Flint is regarded as something of a hard-line toady, aardvark-tongued bootlicker, a member of an active service unit in the Greaser's provisional wing.
To get your hardback copy of Simon's book for half price, go to guardianbookshop.co.uk/Hoggart and enter the code Hoggart. This offer is for 2 weeks only and is exclusive to this podcast.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.